It's taken my next guest half a century to bring herself to write about the atrocities she suffered as a Swiss child living in East Germany under the Hitler regime. Helga Gerhardi now lives with her family in Aylesbury. She's taught at the Oxford College of Further Education. Some of her childhood memories she'll never be able to talk about. They were so awful. Why write about them now?
My children always asked me about my past, and of course they were very excited to hear what it was like in Germany. But I would always stop when it came to the part when I was a refugee, because that was a very hard time. And then my son said one day, people always say if you write about it, you get it out of your system. So I started. I thought, right, let's do it. And I started right at the beginning. I wasn't only just going to write about when I was a refugee. I thought if you write an autobiography, you start from the day you were born. So I started, and the book grew and grew. And in the end, it was quite big, about 800 pages. It was too big.
As you wrote, what happened to you?
I think the early part of my life was easy to write because there was a lot of fun too, which happened, and humour and so on. But the nearer I came to write about being a refugee, I started to get uneasy and frightened, but I was determined to get through it. When I wrote about the time when I left Königsberg, the town where I lived, it was bitter cold. We had 15 degrees below zero. And although I wrote in the summer about it, I sat there still shivering and being cold. I even feel cold now. Thinking about it, I think it was the cold that affected me much more than the hunger and the Russians coming near to us and the shooting. I always said, whatever happens to me in life, I'd never want to be cold again. I must have warmth.
Well, I don't want you to shiver yet. I want to hear about the early part of your life then, about being a youngster, and about being essentially an outsider, somebody from outside, a Swiss person, somebody not of East Germany, but living and being brought up and living with the East Germans, although not identifying with them. I mean, that was crucial, was it not, to your childhood and to the beliefs of your parents and your father in particular?
Yes, I suppose it was. I don't think at first I realised that I was different because I spoke German the same as everybody else. But when Hitler came to power, I think that was the first time when I realised that I was different, because all schools were closed for the day and everybody went to vote. You didn't have a choice. You either said yes or no. And if you said yes, you got a little pin called Ja, and everybody stuck it on their lapel. Well, I was only nine at the time and a child, and it was winter time, and we were building a snowman, and somebody said, haven't you got one of those little Ja pins? I said, what's that? And then they started to explain, you know, my father went voting and we've got this pin. I said, well, my father hasn't got to vote. We're not German. Ah, well, if you're not German, you don't go and vote, then you must be a communist. And of course it finished up in a proper snow fight in the end, because they all thought I was a communist. But it was my father who saw us from the window, and he came out and stopped the fight, and he explained and pointed out that we had no right in Germany to say how it was ruled, because we weren't German. And then, of course, after that, all my school friends joined the Hitler Youth and went off at weekends and had the meetings, and I started to feel lonely because I wasn't allowed to join. But I was permitted once to just go one weekend, and I thought it was great fun, because when you're a young girl and you go with all your school friends in camping, you sort of feel, what have your parents done wrong? Why don't they let you join it? And I think it is only later on that I realized how gradually the youth was indoctrinated with Nazism because of singing the songs, marching songs, and hearing all about Hitler and what he's done, and Göring and Goebbels and their success, and the army started to be built up and so on.
You did point out, though, that there were some positive things about the gatherings, that yes, there was some good done to the poor people
in
the area.
In the meetings, when the girls used to meet, and even also the boys, they did also collect clothes and books, particularly books, because they wanted to send these to German-speaking parts. For example, they had German-speaking people in Poland and even in Russia, and these books were sent off. And they also helped old people. Particularly in the winter time, it was difficult to get coal transport, so the boys and girls used to get their sledges together and had to go and collect the coal for old people. Yes, I think it was sort of a group, you could say, more like the scouts would have been. And because of that, and everybody being so occupied, we didn't have any crime. There was no crime amongst the youngsters. They had no time to be criminals. They were all so very busy. There were paper collection, aluminium collection, there was tins. Everybody had something to do. But any meeting always started with talking about Hitler, and of course the greeting wasn't hello, how are you? It was always Heil Hitler, which was even in school. I mean, school was even worse than that. As soon as the teacher came into class, you know, you'd stand in front of the class and sort of say, Heil Hitler, and then the whole class had to stand up and say, Heil Hitler. That was the greeting. But I don't know whether one really thought of Hitler when one said that. I think it was just as if you said good morning. You didn't think of him. It was only just sort of a greeting.
Did you join in?
Greeting. No, I wasn't allowed to say Heil Hitler. My father didn't like it. But I had a lot of trouble with that, because if we got some young teachers, they used to sort of look at me and say, why didn't you say Heil Hitler? And I started to explain. And I got a little bit ostracized, so I'm afraid in the end I just said Heil Hitler. I was only young and I didn't want to be different.
You met the man himself?
Oh, yes. Well, that was a little accident, I think. It was one day when Hitler came to Königsberg. I had finished my piano lesson. And my father was always away during the week because he had a dairy in Tilsit. And I bought some flowers because I thought he's coming home for the weekend. But I had to cross the road. I couldn't get across because of all the people there. So I had to sort of squeeze through and find a place where it was easy. So I didn't really listen to what was happening. And I heard motorbikes or something, but I didn't take any notice. And I just suddenly squeezed through and ran into the road. And round the corner came Hitler, standing in his car. Well, I was absolutely petrified, and I wanted to run back, but an SS man got hold of me, and of course, seeing I had a little bunch of flowers in my hand, thought I wanted to go and present these to Hitler. And he took me along, and he said, give them to the Führer. Well, my arm just went up, and I gave it to the Führer, and he looked at me. He had very blue and staring eyes, and he just said, why aren't you in uniform? So I said, well, I'm Swiss. But I don't think he heard that, because he sort of lifted his hand up in greeting and was smiling to the crowds. I didn't really exist. And I was trembling, absolutely petrified. I ran to the other side of the road, and I was so glad to get away. When I came home and told my parents about it, my father was petrified. He said, I do hope that's not in the paper, because you are Swiss. You can't go and talk to Hitler, you know. But it wasn't in the paper. So,
how were your family treated by the SS when they were looking at, as the food rationing came in?
Well, we went hard up because my father had a dairy, so I'm afraid my mother did quite a bit on the black market, you know, gave a little bit of butter here and got some coffee and so on. So from the food point of view, that wasn't too bad. But once the war started, the SS always assumed that we might have either secret papers or maybe guns or something like that. And we used to get house searches, and my mother used to be very much afraid of that. We didn't have anything. We might have had the extra bottle of brandy, and my father had a bit of champagne, and we had extra food, which we hid in the cellar, I suppose, so that they didn't see it. But we never had guns or secret papers, because my father wasn't involved in anything like that. But the SS were very, some of them were all right, but some were very cruel, because they used to open a wardrobe where my mother had all her white sheets and blankets and everything, and they just throw them onto the floor and with their black boots kick them up into the air. And of course this meant you got to wash again. And my mother was very often in a terrible state, and if I was home, somehow she felt comfort if I could hold her hand and go round with her. And if we did have anything we wanted to hide, she used to say, well, just get the meal ready. And I used to slip into my father's study and take the few bottles of brandy he had and hide them downstairs in the cellar amongst the potatoes or so, you know, so that they wouldn't find it, because I think any excuse, if they had found something, would have been bad. They would have made made a big fuss about it.
You became a medical student and you looked after the German soldiers who were returning from the Russian front. What sort of conditions did you experience? What sort of condition were they in?
Well, by the time I was a medical student, I'm afraid the Russians had already come pretty far into East Prussia. And there was no medical care at the front, actually. The trains there, there were only cattle trucks with straw, and they used to just throw the wounded in there. And the first station was Königsberg. And I was only young, I was only 19, 20. We opened these cattle trucks, and some of them were already dead. So the first thing we had to do is sort the dead from the live ones. And then we could only do the most necessary care. We kept some behind in the overcrowded hospitals, and the rest had to go to what we called the Reich, which was the rest of Germany. In the end, we didn't even have bandages anymore. We had paper bandages to try and bandage them with. But I think they died from the frost and the cold just as much as from their wounds. And if you don't attend a wound, you soon get gangrene, and that spreads. And I mean, there's... No, it was terrible. We used to have to rip the clothes off, cut off the shoes, and try and do the best we could. But that was towards the end. Hospitals were overcrowded. We had no beds. They slept in the corridors on palliasses and sometimes only on blankets and nothing else. I think it was the young ones that disturbed me very much. Some of them were only 16 and 17, and they used to cry for their mother at night. That was hard.
How vividly do you remember the time when you became a refugee?
Well, I do remember it very well indeed, because I don't think I will ever forget that. When I left home, I was alone when I left home, because somehow, at that particular moment, we were all scattered. Funny thing is, I always remember I even locked the front door, and I took that key round the back, and I hid it in the little place where we always did hide the key. I've never been back. But I started off, it was a matter of just walking, because there were no trains. The farmers, they had their trucks and their carts and their bicycles or wheelbarrows. Some sat on sledges, and children pulled them along. If parents got ill, they pulled them along. But we had also a lot of French prisoners of war and Polish people who had worked on the farms. And although they were enemies, somehow at that moment you weren't an enemy anymore. You were all together, and if you could help one another, you did. But gradually, everybody became very selfish, because if you had two potatoes left in your pocket, you pretended you didn't have anything because you needed it. Well, the time was bad. I mean, there were times when... I think you don't feel hungry anymore after a time, because the hunger just goes away. You stumble along and just think, I'm not going to die, even if you see the bodies next to you, because I don't want to finish like that. But the worst thing is when you start hearing the shooting, or was actually, when I heard shooting, because then I knew that the Russians were pretty close. We had to cross what was called the Huff, which is the frozen part between the Baltic and the mainland. We could not go any further because the Russians already had occupied that part. Now, the Huff is about 10 kilometers long, and although it was 15 to 20 below zero, somehow that was a blessing, because otherwise this part would not have been frozen and we couldn't have walked across it. The Russians knew we were refugees, but they still shot at us. And if the ice broke, I'm afraid the carts and horses just disappeared. When we eventually did get to the other side, there was no food whatsoever. We had no water either. Well, you took snow, but you had to be careful what snow you took to melt, because there was dysentery and A lot of illness, actually. I think it was the children that died and the old people. The others, if they had any strength, kept on going. I was lucky I had found two wounded soldiers, Max and Friedrich, and we joined together. They looked after me and I looked after them. I remember once stumbling along. I was so weak that Max took the bark off the tree and said, "Just eat the bark part. Come on and chew it. You've got to have something in your stomach." Well, my stomach didn't get filled up, and my teeth hurt. I remember my teeth hurting. But I don't know what happened about my stomach. But you just go. You just stumble, and you come to the next place, and you find a little bit of food. People used to throw food away, the ones who had the carts and horses. You see, horses got weak, so they started to throw things out. And if they did that, we used to quickly jump and see whether it was potatoes or... Well, once we even had a piece of bacon. It was frozen stiff, but you could break a piece off. And if you kept it long enough in your pocket, it melted, and you just tried to eat a little bit of that. But eventually, even that part was finished. I lost Max and Friedrich, actually. And I finished up in Stettin, where from there on, I even had jumped onto a train. I even got a lift. But by the time I got to Greifswald, I was terribly ill. I just got to Greifswald station. We had friends there, and I wanted to make my way to them. And I collapsed. Well, when I came to, I thought I was in a dream because I was in hospital, and I had a feather bed. And I had curtains on the window. And I thought, no, this isn't true. I'm still dreaming. I'm still walking along the snow. But it was true. They had to burn my clothes because they said it was impossible to keep any of that. They had to cut my hair because it was so matted. But I even got over that. I found my mother in Greifswald, and we made our way from there to Hamburg because I was frightened that the Russians would even come as far as that. And I thought Hamburg is the one place the British wouldn't leave to the Russians, because that will probably be a harbour where they can bring the boats in. Because in the west, the armies had already got quite far into Germany by then. But we didn't quite make it to Hamburg, my mother and I, because we were on a lorry. And I'm afraid that we had the Spitfires who shot at us. And the lorry burned out and we lost another suitcase. I only had my rucksack left by then. And my mother had one suitcase.
Was there loss of life? Was there loss of life?
Yes. I was lucky because I had experienced a lot before. So when I heard the Spitfires, I said to my mother, we must jump. She didn't want to, and I pushed her out, and I threw the suitcase out, and then I jumped out into the snow before we were shot at. The driver was saved, and he had a woman next to him, his two children. That was fine. But the others, I'm afraid, got killed because they didn't want to jump. They were frightened. We finished up on a farm. The farmer's wife was very kind. And we stayed there until the war finished for us. It hadn't officially finished, but it finished for us because the British came. A funny experience there. I started to work on the farm. Spring had come by then. And we had just put in the cabbage plants when the farmer's wife asked me to go to the village. And off I went. It was pouring with rain. It had rained actually the day before, and I kept on jumping over the puddles. When I came round the corner of the road, I suddenly saw this British tank. And the big gun pointed at me, and I thought, no, I'm not going to die now. After all I've experienced, and this gun pointing at me. So I lifted my arms up. Well, the hatch opened, and the red barrage came out, and then a head, and then a gun. And I thought, no, I'm not going to be shot. And I started to run. And this voice shouted, stop. Well, that's a very international word. You just stop. And I turned round, and two British soldiers climbed out. And they had a map, and they really only wanted to know where they are. And I was able, because my little school English, to explain where they were. And I also said that I was Swiss. And there were no troops in the village, so that was all right. So for us, the war was finished then, but it wasn't actually officially finished. I did find the rest of my family in the end. That is still a very funny story in my book, because after I found my father, he was trying to save his car, and we bought a horse. We called him Heecher. He was a very, very old horse. But we made him pull this car because we wanted to save the car. We had nothing. And if you have a car, you might be able to sell it or at least exchange it some food or something. We got as far as a village when it was night time, and the burgomaster there, or the mayor, put us up for the night. And he said, if you are refugees, he said, we've got an old radio station just on top of the hill, which is empty, and soldiers and officers have lived there, and there should be still accommodation. Why don't you go and try and sleep there and take it over, so to speak? And we did. But unfortunately, there was nothing there. It was empty, and my mother nearly collapsed, because she said, look, how can I live in a place that hasn't even got a bed? There's only palliasse there. But the English were very kind, actually. The occupation forces there supplied us with a bedspread, with a bedstead and one or two blankets or so. But it was only my father, my mother and myself by then. We did live on that radio station for a time. My mother even tried to put some seeds in so we could have some vegetables. But that old horse, Heecher, I'm afraid, trampled everything down, so he had to go. He was sold for a bike, and now my mother's idea was, if I could only make my journey on this bicycle to the south of Germany and see about my sister who was married there, and maybe my other sister would have turned up there and my brother. And I did. It was 800 kilometers, and it was very dangerous on the roads, because all concentration camps, all prisons were opened up, and people, where everybody was trying to find their own home again or get back to their places where they had once been. And I was only a young girl on a bike, so I avoided main roads. I only did the smaller roads, actually. I slept in haystacks. I slept in barns. I had to go from the English occupied Germany to the American occupied Germany. And there I even was put into prison by the Americans. But eventually I did come down to Meinburg, where my sister lived, and I found her and my other sister, and we returned back to the radio station. My brother turned up a few days later, because we had registered by the you had a certain place in Hamburg from the Red Cross, where people used to queue up for days and days in order to fill out cards that they were looking for their relatives, and I had done the same. And my brother apparently found this card and turned up at the radio station. We lived for another winter there, and it was terrible, actually, because food rationing was even shorter than during the war. And I used to go and at night and find what we call mieten. This was where the farmers used to put their, not potatoes, but we had a special root you fed the animals with, and we found that. And my mother became quite ingenious. We had this root either cooked or raw in different shapes. We had it grated, we had it with water, or cooked in thin milk. Oh, I hate root vegetables. Ever since then I hated root vegetables, because that's all we had to eat. But we got through that winter, although my elder sister had her baby there, which was terrible. And when the spring came, well, there were cows in the field, and as I knew how to milk a cow, I even climbed over the fence and used to go and milk the cows in order to have a little bit of milk for my sister and her baby.
Tell me, since that time, you talked about this feeling of looking for your roots and looking for your home. Do you think that the clock has turned full circle? Do you feel that you have found a home? Do you feel
that
you found contentment?
Oh, yes. Oh, I found a home here. Well, I found a home in England. Oh, yes, I'm quite contented. I mean, once I got married, it took me still a few years to settle down, but once I did, yes, I've got I had a good husband and then two children. Yes, I feel now I'm more English than Swiss or even, I never was German, but I still go back to Germany occasionally, because I like to see what it is like. And I'm surprised. I even went back to the eastern part of Germany, and I was shocked to realize how little had been done there. everything stopped from the day has stopped, and that's what it looks like even today.
Helga is published by Verona at £6.99. It's by Helga Chahadi. Thank you.